De la revolución del mundo.
Justice by any means
necessary. This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
All right. Hello. Welcome. My name is Anthony Arnov. I'm an editor at Haymarket Books and a member of Tempest Collective. I'll be chairing this session of Socialism 2024, Lenin and the Politics of Rehearsal, with our speaker, Ruth Wilson Gilmore. I want to thank people who are at home and welcome people at home who are watching the live stream, and also remind people in the room here that any time that we have for questions and conversation will also be part of the live stream. So keep that in mind when choosing to say whatever it is you're here to say. When it comes to that time of the program, I will call on folks to come up to the microphone here. Please keep your comments or questions short. That will allow more comrades to participate in the conversation. In the time we have, we'll limit folks to 3 minutes. I'll let you know when you're at 2.5. But I have to say, yesterday I was thrilled. You know, most people who were contributing in the session that Ruthie did yesterday, I didn't have to tap or remind anyone because people were incredibly concise, and that allowed more folks to share their point of view and perspective, and I hope we can do that again today in the time that we have. Now, for our speaker. Ruth Wilson Gilmore is professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences and American Studies at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. A co-founder of California Prison Moratorium Project and Critical Resistance, she is the author of the prize-winning book Golden Gulag, Prison, Surplus, Crisis, and Opposition in Globalizing California. Her newest book, available in paperback from Verso, is Abolition Geography, Essays Toward Liberation. She also recently wrote The Introduction to Imperialism and the National Question by V.I. Lenin, also published by Verso. We have copies of these books on sale in the Haymarket Books room upstairs, and Ruthie has generously offered to sign books there after this session. So please join me in welcoming Ruthie.
Wow. Hi.
Hi.
How's everyone?
Great.
Great. Me too. I am thrilled to be here. I am thrilled to be reunited with my dear friend, comrade, and colleague, Anthony Arnov. We've known each other a really long time. And it's great to be in the room with so many people. There's still a few chairs. Maybe if you want to sit down, go sit by somebody whose hand is up who needs a listening buddy. Hello to everybody who's streaming in from beyond. I'm hoping my iPad will not fail me because I really need my script. What I'm going to do today is essentially talk us through the combination of reading and extemporizing a good deal of the thinking that went into the introduction to this volume. I was thrilled by the opportunity to write that introduction, thanks to my comrade, friend, and editor, Rosie Warren. And it just gave me the opportunity to think really hard about what all has happened in the last 100 years, and the 100 years before that, and the 100 years before that. And it therefore resonates really tightly with all of the exceptional sessions that have happened at this conference around Palestine, Palestinian struggle for freedom, and 100-plus years of colonialism in that part of the world. So all of these things are connected. If I mention Palestine today, it will be in passing, but not because it's not always on my mind and in my heart. So here we go. Ready? Wait, and now I have to make this thing open. Here it is. Here it is. All right. So the title in here is The Soviets and Abolition. But Anthony had the bright idea, the brilliant idea, to call my talk Lenin and the Politics of Rehearsal. And that title is terrific because it gives you already a sense of where I'm coming from, which is to say how I think we collectively are going to get to where we need to go. So one of my principal beliefs that shapes everything I do is that practice makes different. It doesn't make perfect. Practice makes different. And I came to the understanding of this, that practice makes different, through many years of really quite miserable teaching at the University of Southern California, where I had incredible, outstanding, wonderful graduate students. And I was compelled to teach an enormous undergraduate lecture course that students had to take for so-called, diversity requirements. So they were all resentful. And I mean all of them. And I know some of you are thinking, oh, white, bougie students. I mean all of them were resentful that they had to sit through what I had to say about the topic of all things, Los Angeles and the American dream. Imagine them feeling resentful about that. They did. But of the 250 or 300 students who resented their way into the auditorium twice a week and resented their way through the exams and the papers, there were always 30 or 40 who were really interested. They sat down front. They had their notebooks out or their laptops open, but they weren't playing Sudoku or shopping. They were listening. And they also were the few who would come to office hours. So I got to know them, and I started to notice a pattern. I'm a social scientist. I look for patterns. And the pattern that I noticed was that those students tended to fall into three general groups. They were artists, athletes, and engineers. That's who was interested in what I was teaching in Los Angeles and the American dream. The engineers' interest came from their already pretty well developed understanding that the way we understand the world is through understanding systems and structures in order to revise or change systems and structures. All the engineers got that. So when I go on and on about systems and structures, they go, yeah, of course. Obvious. The artists and athletes, in a complementary way to the engineers, whatever they thought about systems and structures, all knew from their own habits that practice makes different. Athletes know it, and artists know it, and artists know it in part through making something which always require you do something to some medium and then you do something else. Practice makes different. So that leads me to one of my main men of the 20th century, Bertolt Brecht. You're a man too? Yes. And And Bertolt Brecht was extremely influential on me when I was a student of drama in my undergraduate and my first pass-through graduate school years in the late 60s and up until the mid-1970s. And the aspect of Brecht's enormous work that thoroughly shaped me was the work that's kind of concentrated in the Little Organon, but also turns up in so many versions of his thinking and doing about learning theater or didactic theater or theater that matters for people who are trying to change their world by understanding it, and also who want to be entertained. Like, Brecht really believed in entertainment, and you might notice, so do I. And one of the lessons I took from Brecht from then, when I was in my 20s, and now I'm in my 70s, is to understand that having a guide to practice, whether it's theory or something else, is not to have a blueprint, much less a script, but rather a model. And that the model is always something that can be manipulated, changed. We start with the model and work our way forward. So it's not an ideal type, but it's what we work from. This is a model that we work from. And thinking the model with Brecht, and thinking, therefore, how the shows developed, whether it's Antigone or Galileo or the different shows that Brecht and company put together, brought me to an understanding of what Brecht and his comrades understood and what I think we're all trying to understand here at Socialism 2024 and in all of our organizations and everyday lives, and that is, how we can at once present a view into society in such a way that those who are not party to that presentation come to understand in the course of the presentation that the presentation depends on all of us, meaning, therefore, that the society represented is also the society that will, through participation, change. Right? That this question of representation has an openness to it that is necessary for social change, for revolutionary change. And that means, finally, and then I'm going to slip into my more prepared remarks, that means we are constantly working back and forth between object and subject, between subjectivity as historical becoming and objectivity as historical constraint. Becoming constraint. And it's in that dynamic realm of becoming and constraint, or to go back to something I said a little earlier, thinking about the model in its plasticity and how we manipulate and change and grow it by growing and changing and manipulating ourselves. And I'm using manipulate as a good word, not a bad word. That rehearsal comes to the fore. Obviously, for Brecht, for the theater company, for theater, rehearsal is a necessity, and understanding that practice makes different is exactly where we need to go as political actors in this world. Practice makes different. Or, as I have gotten in the habit of saying recently, abolition is emancipation in rehearsal. All right, so here we go. It's school time. All right. Lenin was present in my early consciousness of politics and communism. The Soviets and us. I'm going to turn on my clock so I can keep track. In this instance, us was some combination of capital N Negro peoples, soon to become black in the United States, who were involved in the post-World War II round of emancipation. Universalist and internationalist in ambition, this movement linked up and shared inspiration and analysis with global anti-imperial liberation movements. The weapon of theory, as we understood it, was meant to both guide and respond to action. Guide and respond. We had to repeatedly assess our own resources. Was anything consistently reliable? We were constantly debating and acting on our insights about how to fight, which included making decisions about what we were fighting. In other words, the struggles and the people who fought them developed constantly, driven by the ongoing effort to know the dynamic objects of our antagonism. Why? Because we wanted to win. In order to evade being absorbed, which is to say formally but not really emancipated, into a social reality that would perpetuate the domination that generations organized to undo, we had not only to resist culturally and politically, but also to build our awareness of organized violence as an ensemble of activities impeding abolition in general. This ensemble of activities turns every what into a where, because violence is always a spatial practice that produces and defines territories, peoples, mobility, and possibility. So if capitalism reached its highest stage at the beginning of the 20th century, it surely hasn't run out of energy. Capitalism, saving capitalism from capitalism, is a way to think about the mode of production's necessary dynamic through which it realizes its inherent imperative, which is always to make money more. Right? That's the inherent imperative. Whatever problem production or accumulation runs up against, innovation appears to resolve. Technological and financial barriers to entry enable capitals that innovate with particular time-space felicity to dominate and eventually monopolize. What Lenin noticed in thinking about finance, monopoly, and imperialism is akin to what many kinds of intellectuals throughout modernity keep noticing too. Tools for innovation comprise technologies of many kinds, productive but also political, military, murderous. There is no singular rationality of power, as my dear friend Herman Bennett continuously reminds us of. So I thought we could think with Lenin to think about different ways we can make our way through this unrolling present. So I'm going to meditate a bit on why we should read Lenin's writing. What do these writings show us about theory breaking into practice? And how might the politics explained or implied in these writings and in other things that we encounter inform our analytical and practical grasp of what is to be done now? And how are these two key concepts, imperialism and the national question, how are they explored here by Lenin, and why are they relevant today? The organized violence of imperialism continues to stalk the earth in the form of its fleshly and ghostly remnants, accumulated under development, and viscerally in contemporary unequal relations of power that rush value upward by way of elites to the economic north, wherever the owners might live. So, you know, there's been all that coverage of that big month-long fancy wedding of the Ambanis or somebody in India. Like, they can live there. They are the north for our purposes. All right? But in its muscular liveliness, self-determination, what underlies the national question is self-determination, hasn't disappeared from the Earth's surface, nor wholly been absorbed into the system of nation states, mostly disciplined by debt and developmentalism. So we should read as though we're thinking with Lenin in his time, while also thinking about the struggle at hand, to think Marxism's contemporary practicality, so that that doesn't get lost. And I think there's so much anxiety, especially here in North America, especially in the United States, about Marxism. It's like, relax. Most Marxists aren't men, they're not white, and they're not in the global north. Like, get a grip. That said, a good deal of mainstream Western Marxism seems culturally shaped by a quest for truth revealed on the page. Sound kind of familiar? That might be because so many of its adherents are themselves born-again historical materialists. And I've said that to some of them to their face. Their fundamentalism is barely Methodist, though method plays a big role in the confusion, but actually a lot more Calvinist. The sober assessment of how the world works casts a shadow dividing the elect from the rest in austere dismissal of politically meaningful conditions of existence and analytically powerful categories of analysis. More than communism, it would seem the specter of Weber haunts the West. I should sit down there. So there was always something about, and this is a little revealing too much about myself, there was always something about Lenin to my youthfully vigorous mind. Remember, I was born in 1950. There was always something about him that was other than the West. Always. And this was due in part to reassuring, if really reprehensible, presumptions about physique. What people look like. Eyelids, cheekbones, other aftermaths of the racist science of humanity that raged as he came of age. But something else too, less easy to confess, but viscerally there as well, a peculiarly not liberal universalism that offered theoretical muscle for the struggle at hand as something we all could and should exercise. One night in the late 1960s, during the point-counterpoint of assassinations and riots, I wandered through town looking for my father in hope of a ride home. He'd been invited to speak at a teach-in, like this. A teach-in, one of those noisy aftermaths to the din of politics and fire and sirens and bullets and protest, in which people try to craft sentences out of the crisis of churn. His cred was street. Whatever he said, though most certainly in the style of harangue, would have tightly followed the locally fatal contours of power and difference. He would have insisted on how those contours at once originated from and radiated in dynamic connection to liberation struggle in general. Well, I skipped that talk and finally found my father's car. with the event flyer stuck under the windshield wiper. Somebody had circled his name and annotated the flyer, "He looks like Lenin." That word's from that Lenin, not my father Lenin. "What a fine thing our Congress is," he said. "Opportunities for open fighting and opinions expressed. Tendencies revealed. Groups defined. Hands raised. A decision taken. A stage passed through. That's what I like. That's life. It's something different from the endless, wearying intellectual discussions which finish not because people have solved the problem, but simply because they have got tired of talking." 1903. So two major themes enroll in this text, and I'm going to lift them up bit by bit in my talk. In the imperialism pamphlet, Lenin proposed a broad understanding of why and how capitalist competition, rather than developing the productive forces for humanity to flourish, degenerates into monopoly and war. The argument turns on a key phrase summarizing the ongoing result: partition and repartition. In the various debates on self-determination, Lenin is at pains to specify how imperialism's inbred contradiction, materialized in the form of oppressed nations themselves, might emerge and align as social forces capable of interrupting imperialism's tendency towards war and extraction, and thereby set humanity onto a different, though not final, path. Much has been made of the co-constitutive interdependencies, which is to say the fundamental contradiction, if you will, between imperialism on the one hand and self-determination on the other. In our time together this afternoon, we'll meditate on how Lenin's analysis helps us reflect on specifically grounded examples, not as remnants of what might have been, but as energetic possibilities arising from refreshed struggle today. The 20th century liberation movements remain unfinished, although not thoroughly vanquished. Through organized intensity in the broader context of anti-colonial revolution, the Marxism of the Third World reconfigured a good deal of the planet's social reality. These revolutionaries never lacked Lenin, even as they frequently and deliberately reworked the thinking proposed from capitalism's rapidly industrializing imperial periphery, Russia. They did so to address problems of how to make and sustain freedom elsewhere. The Third World's emancipatory interregnum wasn't peaceful, as we know, serially sliced open by assassinations and coups, intended to turn back even moderate attempts at socialism and put people back on a capitalist track. And yet, with all that suffering, for a few decades, broadly speaking, humanity flourished. And this is only broadly speaking, and we can talk endlessly about all the exceptions to what I'm about to say. The planet's human population has grown from about 1.4 billion the year Lenin was born, 1870, same year my grandfather was born, to about 8 billion today. The most dramatic year-on-year increases were during this interregnum I'm talking about, tapering off since the counter-revolution cumulatively took hold. So are people tired of making more people? Some countries appear as such. Are people lacking adequate nutrition again as they were before and during the two great imperial wars? Why, yes, they are, although not everywhere. We see here basic features of today's predicaments elaborated through globalization on the one hand and ecological disaster on the other. More than a century's dust has settled since Lenin conceived and wrote these texts, and he was writing some of these long before he passed. The world as we find it has not resolved the contradictions that hold these writings together. Domination confronts self-determination, while economic territory is key to our understanding of the social realities in and through which struggle occurs. A contemporary to us, current, contemporary-spirited and frequently ill-tempered debate asks whether the concept of imperialism, either Lenin's or a fresher version of it, offers necessary insight into today's dynamics of domination. I lean toward yes. The combination of institutional tools for transferring surplus from the economic South, wherever it is, to the North, whoever they are, has become more elaborate, yes, but is still tied together by the effective control of military, technology, productive and financial, money, property, and most people's ability to move about or stay put. The no side insists that contemporary firefights should be against national bourgeoisies that were never appropriately disempowered, either in a peaceful transition to socialism or by other means. Well, given how frequently such national bourgeoisies have depended on overt and covert support to interrupt redistribution, restricting interpretive energy to the nation-state scale obscures wider forces articulating, connecting those bourgeoisies whose agency is not in doubt, even if their autonomy is, like all autonomy, only ever relative. But relative to what? Here's where Lenin's impressive exploration of self-determination helps us to think hard about what now contours economic territory as it stretches across borders and nestles within them. If self-determination a century ago appeared to communism's most successful strategist as an urgent social energy confronting imperialism within and across regions, his care in specifying context strongly militates against the notion of any narrowly identitarian nation as miraculously poised to do battle. Here many raise M.N. Roy's 1920 Comintern debate with Lenin as transformative for Lenin's understanding. Is everybody with me? Okay, good. Yes. And yet, political analysis concerning the possible participants in revolutionary formation characterize Lenin's pieces that long predate that debate. The doubt that shaped those pieces helped make the Comintern debate possible. I'm going to repeat that. The doubt that shaped those pieces helped make the debate possible. Consider a wider context. Lenin, Roy, and the Toilers of the East, who actually hailed from many directions on the planet, were talking about self-determination at the same time that apologists and hacks, alongside the occasional serious scholar, were writing for organs like the Journal of Race Development and otherwise figuring out how to make the world safe for capitalism. So this is the context of all of this. Stated differently, the analytical preconditions for the 1920 revision were already present because the one abiding characteristic of Lenin's thought was that it was open, in rehearsal rather than reprint. This is a brief for Roy and Lenin, and a lesson for all of us now. The purpose here is not to hold Lenin up as immune to error. That would be plain stupid. But rather to ask ourselves how better to think systematically and strategically and collectively, in part by listening carefully, to accomplish what we came to do. If we can imagine that the struggle is over economic territory, including what happens to and on the land, our imaginative capacity demands we understand that it's a beginning, not the end. We also know, whether thinking about self-determination or the exposition of consolidated competing forces presented in the imperialism pamphlet, that any territory has natural, cultural, political, and other interdependent characteristics, i.e., analytically, we can talk about economic territory, but if that's all we think about, we're missing the mark to start. These characteristics or endowments include water and land and other tangible and intangible resources, as well as the presence of institutions through which people organize, derive meaning from, and improve their lives. Organize their lives, derive meaning from their lives, and improve their lives. This isn't a romantic point. Self-determination from the communist perspective is shorthand for imagining these endowments marshaled by history's protagonists, and then finding that work as it actually happens to revise social reality. Therefore, part of the struggle is defining, which is to say becoming, history's protagonists repeatedly. Relations of power accumulated and expressed through social processes determine the possibility, scope, and urgency of emancipatory struggle. It's also the case that self-determination is vulnerable to capture by liberalism, especially liberalism's paternalistic embrace of group individualism. What am I talking about? Group individualism. Black people this and Latinos that and Palestinians this and whoever that. Liberalism's paternalistic embrace of group individualism, which itself is partly motivated out of fear of fascism and the absurd but sturdy belief that fascism can be domesticated. Stated differently, self-determination compels us to confront analytically and practically the actual substantive and formal initiatives through which it can, but hardly must, move toward openness. We will explore some examples probably in an hour, the rate I'm going. But for now, what's important is to contrast radical self-determination with liberalism's seduction, because the latter, at best, promises to enlarge already existing social reality to accommodate a slight variation of what already exists, with predictably brutal effects for everyone abandoned at the margin of that reality. Now, let me put this to you in completely different terms. In 2010, I was the president of the American Studies Association. And one of the things I said in my presidential address was that the various contradictions that I laid out in my much too long talk then resulted in, among other things, in the fact in 2010 that there was one black man in the White House and a million black men in the big house. This is what I mean about a little incorporation at the edge and brutal exclusion of everyone else. And a certain candidate for the blue ticket is the same. I think that's like legal to say on TV. Lenin proposed a century ago that the highest stage of capitalism took formal and substantive shape through imperialism, as competing polities in the hunt to control economic territory arrayed themselves for war on behalf of their domestic monopolies, with finance in the lead. The subsequent explosive backwash of Axis and Allied industrialized killing, colonialism's long-suffered genocide and environmental destruction inundating the core, may have signaled the end of 20th century wars among late modernity's last standing imperialists, but this was by no means the end of imperialism or of powerful war makers. Philosophers get cranky when concepts degenerate into metaphor, even though that's where concepts originate in the first place, as energizing capacities to think relationally about the world. That said, imperialism, as I'm using it, is no metaphor. The partition and repartition of the earth never ground to a halt, even if the great pressures that are externally determined cooperate and conflict differently to produce territories ripe for exploitation. The national bourgeoisies act on their own institutional behalf, becoming fabulously wealthy in the process, and meet demands that drain resources. I mean, we all know this. Militaries lurk around the planet. Number one is the United States of America. But militaries lurk around the planet, poised to enforce or interrupt value transfer, which is another way of saying that claims on resources do not redound without friction to those who live with or work them. The expansive forces of organized violence, also perfected in public and private policing bodies, meet up alongside less apparently warlike yet still murderously destructive forces of international financial institutions, trade agreements, intellectual property, NGOs. Together, these forces insinuate the concertina wire of civil society into fraying political fabric. Abetted decline, as Rahman Idrissa puts it. While pundits, as well as people who experience organized abandonment, decry failed or captured states. Such a constellation of forces appears to constitute imperialism, neither more nor less naked than at the turn of the previous century or the century before that, or the century before that. Monopolies matter, whether chartered or otherwise consolidated through protected competition. Monopolies have military and fiduciary seconds everywhere, even as extraction, appropriation, and the transfer of value to the coffers of the rich continue apace. They don't always win, but they rarely lose. Who or what constitutes self-determination in this context, or in these contexts? If the goal of creating or seizing a state is what self-determination has meant, conceptually, what mediating movements headed in such a direction matter today? Like, with or without the state? And those are questions we have to ask ourselves. We can't just shrug something off. In other words, does learning about discrete cases where the armature of sovereignty isn't a near goal distinct from or built towards the need for big things? Might such learning show us ways of seeing, as it were, what the Soviets plus electrification might mean in practice today? And by the way, for those of you, three of you in the audience who don't know, early in the successful years of the Bolshevik Revolution, some reporter asked Lenin, well, how are you going to keep this thing going? And Lenin said, it's pretty straightforward. The Soviets and electrification. Power, people, power, electrical. And I have a whole talk about that, but I gave it 2 years ago. Soviets plus electrification. I lost my place again. There it is. Lenin noticed during the St. Petersburg general strike something that surprised him, that the St. Petersburg Soviet would keep society going. He had not expected this. So much, he was like the most successful strategist who didn't have it all figured out. There was no blueprint. I can't say that enough times. He was surprised that it would keep society going. This surprise shows, as I just said, there wasn't a set revolutionary blueprint, but something happened in the realm of becoming, rehearsal, profoundly social conviviality determined the political subjective means for realizing interim goals. And I know that's a mouthful, but you can read it in here. This, in turn, showed how revolution is a fundamentally practical program, even if the steps cannot all be plotted out in advance. We are from the Communist Party, and we are here to help you solve your problems. Let's leap. The capacity to leap into an unknown that promises both terror and salvation is the foundation of Christian evangelical conversion. In the first decades of the 20th century, while Lenin was writing these pieces and fomenting revolution, evangelism spread as it had a century earlier and the century before that. Getting a pattern here? This indicates a general puzzle that really interests me. Scholars of religion, scholars of historical geographical materialism, and others who seek to grasp the complexities of subjectivity wonder what compels people to reinterpret abstract principles and reinvent themselves through that reinterpretation. Isn't that interesting? Like, this is what we're all doing. We're reinterpreting abstract principles and reinventing ourselves through the reinterpretation. It's not just writing. It's embodied. Beyond the urgent need to assuage suffering, including the kind of suffering that Marx wrote about a lot, which was inactivity and loneliness, which is something I think we can all understand, evangelical millenarianism, again as an example, features news of certain change. Right? So it's not just about the suffering, but there's this news of certain change. Adherents devote great subjective effort to imagining and embodying change in preparation for change, while hurtling toward the brink of an objectively irresistible unknown. From time to time, evangelical eruptions have, through organized activity and polemic, connected with various emancipatory movements that might fall under the aegis not narrowly of wage worker class politics, but also expansively abolitionism. They have worked towards embracing everybody in a territory of need. Now, it is true that throughout modernity, the disciplining forces of religious hierarchy enabled capture, exploitation, subjugation, transfer, and genocide to realize value. And yet, the dialectics of moral value have also meant that even if explicitly faith-schooled to displace or pacify oppositional energy, people, still talking about historical protagonists here, people have socially fashioned something they could use for their own purpose from the symbolic and material resources at hand. And further, while this self-fashioning, and I don't mean it like just like individualistically, and yet I recognize that there are 8 billion selves on this planet. Both things. And yet, wait a minute, no, yes, no, and further, not and yet, and further. It's always something. And further, while this self-fashioning did not necessarily instigate capacities for creative aggression, it did, amidst immense spiritual diversity and syncretism, broaden and strengthen those capacities. Right? So you can think liberation theology, you can think so many things. Awareness brings examples to our mind. So here's just a little example. In 1906, when labor actions erupted across South Africa, Jehovah's Witnesses appeared ready to proselytize alongside secular agitators. So there were communists or union organizers, and then boom, there are Jehovah's Witnesses all over the waterfront. And those who took up their pamphlets, so you imagine what that proselytizing looks like, is you hand somebody a pamphlet. Those who took up those pamphlets had, among other things, literacy in their collective arsenal. Right? Now, it could be that somebody took a pamphlet who themselves couldn't read or didn't read that language, but they took it anyway, and what was on that page eventually became revealed to them because somebody else could read, somebody else knew English, or whatever, whatever. Right? In other words, perhaps a central lesson for Lenin: learning is never an indifferent antithesis, even if the dominant pedagogy intends conformity, not rebellion. And this is why we're going through all this struggle in schools in the United States today. And further, as we reflect on today's evangelical enthusiasm for harvesting souls, especially souls across the wide swathe of tropical landmass on either side of the equator, we are reminded these terrains form part of the economic territory besieged by domestic, international, and transnational monopolies and their political, non-governmental police and militarized enablers. Social structures that enhance belonging make evangelism's appeal sensible while when converts do not otherwise feel that they can fulfill their purpose. Right? It's like so not shocking. I put my finger on evangelism here to make a point that evangelism does not even remotely exhaust. Purpose, rather than characteristics or interest. I lost it again. Okay, purpose, rather than characteristics or interest, initiates and determines so much of political and social life. While religion, through dense systems of signification, appeals abstractly as few other social forces do, its felt practicality in relation to subjectivity, which is to say to becoming, suggests clues one might look for in building formations that are this worldly in their orientation to relieve suffering and produce joy. Such this worldliness, perhaps, is what radical self-determination always was making its way through, with nations sometimes as scriptively real, but also importantly, a loose stand-in for a wide range of collectivities combined in excess of oppression, yet undeniably consolidated by oppression. So it's more than oppression, even if the pressures of oppression consolidate the collectivity. We are from the Communist Party, and we're here to help you solve your problems. That's the kind of refrain of this talk. So I have a whole long section on economic territory, but I think you've got the drift of it. But kind of a concluding remark, if the struggle for domination under capitalism consists of the struggle over territory as economic territory, then self-determination is both in dialectical antagonism to control from outside or above, and replete with its own internal struggles, none of which has an automatic outcome, anti-capitalist or otherwise. A century on, Where does struggle to emancipate an economic territory by transforming it into something else, which is to say liberating or emancipating its many endowments in collective direction into making the world we want, where does it arise and where does it lead? How might we recognize the social characteristics of such struggles today? Whether the intention is to make values flow or stick, and different collectivities have different intentions. Symbolic, no less than material determinations of authorized belonging heighten struggle. So the three huge eruptions of capitalist modernity, colonialism, settler colonialism, and chattel slavery, threw people and places into motion, characterized by intense friction that goes by different names. Deindustrialization, underdevelopment, genocide, racism. And we can add to those names, but that gives you an example, a list of what I mean. All these forces are part of imperialism rather than extra-imperial activities because they are resolved through partition, repartition, war, and sorting and stacking people, places, and things. Like any other border, partitions can be invisible and depthless, even if they are fortified with soldiers, landmines, towers, walls, floodlights, or visible from space, because practices of tillage or irrigation leave evidence that show up as though defined by a cartographer's paint box. It is definitive and transformative and changes all kinds of relations from household regimes to how the planet looks from outer space. Partitions distort and sometimes obliterate social reality, and emplotment gives definition and meaning to partition as the geometrical ordering of space and the narrative ordering of time. Now, to make that more concrete, the discussion we've been having here and that people have been having since October 7th about the history of Palestine versus the history, the official history of Israel, gives us an understanding of the geometrical ordering of space and the narrative ordering of time that has intense, and in this case, genocidal effects. This is not like an abstract intellectual notion that I'm sharing with you, but actually something that we must all take seriously. We can concentrate our attention on big things and global processes by considering two centuries, for example, of capital mobility and banking crises. They show a very peculiar thing. The few decades in which mobility and crises were low, which was around 1945 to 1980, so that's also the worst time of the last 100 years of Palestine, and yet globally low in general, correspond to the decades during which, in fits and starts, people were making a decolonized future, the emancipatory interregnum we've already touched on. That brief period suggests, therefore, what incited counter-revolution, stated most generously as the thirst for cash. The assembled forces of counter-revolution from outside and within the economic territories in question figured out through trial and error how to use combinations of extra economic as well as economic pressure to realize cash from property entitlements. So today we cannot emphasize enough that the forces of austerity and its related enterprises of abandonment and depoliticization have broadened and deepened inequality on a global scale. And yet, just skipping a whole bold-faced complaint, you got my complaint, so let me see what I can do. The universal openness towards which third world internationalism urged itself, in a contradiction that comes as no surprise, tended both to oppose and to strengthen the power of partitions. If I put up a border and say on this side we're all socialists, that partition is supposed to be meaningful for self-determination, right? In turn, partitions can be as likely to revive as to remedy the antagonisms history's protagonists keep slugging away at. But to repeat, in the brief period following the end of the old imperial order, the greatest year-over-year increases in the number of human lives happened. So pretty much like, I'm part of the baby boom. There was like a boom all over the planet. It wasn't just here in the rich global north. If the point of Marxism lies in anything, it's in figuring out communist philanthropy. The antagonistic contradiction to all other forms of philanthropy. There's no private allocation of the stolen social wage, nor is there competitive application or status-restricted eligibility for public social wage reserves. So imagine abundance as entitlement that binds us in radical interdependence. Imagine that. Just imagine it, and then do something to realize it. Mutual aid is a modest form of communist philanthropy. While the challenge is to imagine meeting needs and desires of strangers one can't touch or of despised people one might prefer not to be around. Skipping ahead, 5 more minutes? Are we good? Okay. Okay, skip. This is... All right, here we go. This, trying to find my way to a conclusion. Contemporary abolition arose in creative antagonism to the widening scope of militarism, police, prisons, and punishment as all-purpose solutions to social problems. Wherever inequality is deepest, incarceration and all the relations necessary to hold people against their will for part or all of their lives is most prevalent. Inequality here isn't measured by income alone. Rather, it indicates the capacity for people to use creatively the territorial endowments which form their social realities. Most modestly, the goal of social reproduction promises, as Gargi Bhattacharya puts it, learning early in life and rest towards the end. The organized abandonment that signifies repartitioned territory produces geographies where it takes more and more human and not human energy to keep lives and households together. Wherever organized abandonment occurs on the planet's surface, the composition of communities, not identical with labor forces, weighs heavily on a land that does not house or feed or employ or care for those people. It's useful to remember that the economic South is a condition of existence rather than a set of coordinates. Political elites and those who line up with them agree that more police are the appropriate response to whatever social challenges arise. Police state socialists here in the United States, you know what I'm talking about, agree with this appraisal, confusing organized violence with the capacity to minimize vulnerability to harm. The latter abolitionist goal in stark contrast to a rush to punish harm more swiftly after it happens. The forces of organized violence frequently employ people who come from communities not altogether unlike those destined for brutal control. So that is also a central contradiction here in the United States and beyond. Like all these big cities in the United States today have black pro-cop mayors, with the possible exception of Chicago. Possible. But they do. They do. And police forces full of people who seem demographically identical to... Okay. So let's think through an example. And then I promise I'll wrap up. The politics of policing are actually obvious. Let's take a police baton. Truncheon is the word because this is a British publication. And it makes for a nice little rhyme, as you will hear. Let's take a truncheon. For a cop to be paid to use a truncheon to bust your head open means the truncheon maker had a contract to produce truncheons, not luncheons. which means a whole series of political decisions about the allocation of material and symbolic resources already steadied the cop's hand before she raised it. But also, in bringing it down, she applied violence to create power for herself, for cops, for truncheon makers, for the process of resource allocation, for the government that runs on a platform of criminalization to justify taxes, to use the social wage for that purpose. And there's more. Your head was there, beneath that falling truncheon, because of an entire series of decisions or defeats over where your head might be or whether your life might be. The sum of organized abandonment put the territory of yourself beneath that truncheon. Now, you might be there because you decided to go out and fight the cops. That doesn't make all the systemic analysis beside the point. Nobody's saying anybody's a passive victim, right? You can be a historical protagonist and still have that truncheon bust your skull wide open. The weapon of theory doesn't neutralize the truncheon, but it shows how it got there to your head and therefore gives some clues about making the world otherwise. So, because I have talked much longer than I thought I would, I will give you like just three teaser examples that we can talk about in whatever few minutes we have for Q&A. And that is that I have encountered, sometimes directly, sometimes indirectly, various social movements on this planet today who are rehearsing emancipation, doing so by interrupting the market in land, by creating agricultural and residential communities, not in order to withdraw from the already existing system of resource capture and allocation signified by states, but rather to form more secure and politically aware collectivities to demand that those resources become available to the people in those communities, while at the same time saying, and this is MST in Brazil and Abishali in South Africa, where we live and work is no longer in the market. It is not for sale, and it is not for rent. And those all started with land occupation, so that is the antagonistic contradiction to colonial occupation, right? It's emancipatory occupation. And then I have another example of large-scale labor unions. Also, we can understand as social movements. One that I was going to talk about at great length, except for they just endorsed that prosecutor, so I won't. But there's still like a whole lot of really amazing work happening in that labor union that brings us clearly to our vision how internationalism, labor struggle, globalization of healthcare, capitals, long-distance migrants who work in healthcare, and solidarity across borders can become more powerfully meaningful. And the fact of that endorsement doesn't erase all the stuff that happened, right? That can keep on happening. The momentum is there. So last thing, read the winners, read Lenin. In the late 1990s, a piously gleeful group gathered at Berkeley to celebrate the establishment of a new PhD program in African American Studies. Was anyone there? Anyone here there? Okay. Speaker after speaker laid out an understanding of how we got into where we were, citing key texts and categories and concepts, most of which turned on culture, which is, of course, not an unimportant thing, as I hope I've shown. Well, then the late, great John Bracey got up to share his remarks. I heard that. And may his memory be a blessing. Right now it is. And so the late, great John Bracey, a lifelong laser sharp stalwart of Africana studies, shrugged off a lot of what had been claimed as the intellectual lineages for a doctoral program devoted to the study of the ongoing struggle for emancipation. He said, read the winners. Read Lenin. There are many well-documented big examples we could consider as the Agrarian South Network and others try to figure out how to regulate the private sector, build independent united fronts, and practice something that both proponents and detractors call resource nationalism. Lenin showed how we reveal the new world through criticism of the old. Now, here I'm not talking about Eastern Hemisphere, Western Hemisphere. I mean, what has been and what is becoming. These examples, brought into focus by thinking with his writing on imperialism and self-determination, encourage us to see possibilities arising through old and newer institutional forms. This raises some questions. If the Soviets today, these social movements I think of as Soviets, are diversified, what helps them connect? Does there need to be a party or a constellation of parties that enable some participants at least to move through and with movements according to a sturdy, if not fixed, sense of orientation? The fact we read books like this one strongly suggests the answer is yes, we need parties, but then where do we see realization that doesn't become weighted down by blueprints and bureaucratization? The answer seems to be to look at large-scale organizations. I gave you just a little brief taste of the MST, Abishali, and NNU, and pay attention to how they refresh and strengthen their ongoing works shaped by constant political education and debate. Are these proto-parties? They're certainly political, and parties need not be parliamentary. Right? They don't have to be. They tend to become. There are some potentially useful lessons as we think about forming and deepening Soviets in their diversity. One is to look at a state like Kerala in India, Southwest India, and take seriously the effort it has required over time to make and remake itself while expanding participation. The word democratizing comes to mind, but it might not be adequate to the descriptive task. Another is to take Kerala's relative sovereignty seriously and consider other territorial political formations, with the new municipalism raising some invigorating expectation that it might be possible, at least provisionally, to secure public goods that aspire to communist philanthropy. If the purpose is to change everything, which is my purpose, it is therefore to make big things. Electrification to power the power of the Soviets. Then that means figuring things out and patiently explaining them. To do that requires listening. Listening enhances learning. Expect surprise. Stay true to purpose. Be creatively aggressive. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.